Welcome. We are continuing our series, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, our small group and preaching series based on the book by Peter Cesaro this week. And this week's focus is called The Journey Through the Wall, or The Journey Through the Dark Night of the Soul, but it could also easily be called The Journey That Makes No Sense. And we will see that as we read through perhaps one of the hardest stories in the Old Testament. So would you turn with me now to Genesis chapter 22? We're going to read from verse 1 all the way through 18. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. And as the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and the wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told them about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns, and he went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. And so Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide," and to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, by my own name, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." If I had been the editor of the Bible, I would have edited this story out. It has always disturbed me tremendously. I remember a good friend of mine, an Old Testament scholar, so someone who really loves the Old Testament dearly, lamenting that this was always one of the stories included in her little girl's picture Bible. "How can I teach this story to my girls?" she asked. "How do I explain the character of God to them from this horrifying scene?" It reminds me of the time a child ran from one of our Sunday school classes crying because of all the people and animals that didn't get on to Noah's Ark. Yes, if I were the editor of the Bible, I would have made a few changes. I think our God, our all-loving, ever-merciful, benevolent creator, puts himself in some pretty compromising and tricky situations, and I would like to get him out. And I haven't been satisfied with the explanations and sermons that kind of dance their way around and over this profoundly troubling issue. Because this is no fairy tale. This is our faith, and this is our God. His name is on the line here. What would you have done if you were Abraham? I mean, honestly, what would you have done? If I think about it honestly, I think I would have failed the test, and gladly. Abraham, on the other hand, does not fail the test. He passes it, and he passes with flying colors, and so he seems to be this otherworldly spiritual giant, or a psycho. And the only way I've been able to understand this story in the past is by making it into kind of a myth, or in other words, just not thinking too hard about it. But here's the thing I've come to learn about Abraham, the thing that forces me to wrestle honestly with this story. God didn't choose Abraham because he was this incredible man of faith, this spiritual guru, you know, the only one on the face of the earth. He chose Abraham because he was incredibly ordinary, a classic Joe Blow. Nobody special. He was just this ordinary human guy on the face of the earth. And when God chose Abraham, it was giant risk. But worth it. Because what it says to all of us is that anybody at all, who is willing to partner with God can be an agent for incredible blessing and transformation in the world. Anybody could do what Abraham did. Which means anybody, you or I, could have passed the test in Genesis chapter 22. Despite its absurd, horrifying, absolutely confusing nature, you and I could have responded faithfully to God's request, and we can continue to, because that's what the grander story of Abraham tells us. So how can this be, and why would we want to? Well, we're going to take a look at this story in three sections. It splits easily into three sections marked by three summons or calls. So the first one is God calling to Abraham. He says, Abraham, Abraham, in verse 1, and Abraham responds, here I am. And the second call is by Isaac in verse 7. He says, Father, where's the lamb? And Abraham responds to him. And the third summons is in verse 11, when the angel of the Lord says, Abraham, Abraham, and Abraham responds. So we're going to walk through each of these sections today to try and better understand how we too might respond to the God who doesn't always act towards us in the ways that we think he should, or in the ways that we even think make sense. The story begins in verse 1 with the words, after these things, God tested Abraham, which makes us ask, after what things? Well, after a lot of things. We find this story in the book of Genesis, which is the very first book in the Bible that sets up the whole story from Genesis to Revelation. And so Genesis is a really important story, and the things that happen early on in Genesis set up the themes that carry throughout the rest of Scripture. So after all these things, what does it refer to? Well, it means after God created the world, and Adam and Eve messed it up, after Noah and his family repopulated an almost obliterated earth, after humanity tried to prove themselves over and over and over again, only to make more and more of a mess. And after God chose this one ordinary guy named Abraham to be his partner in spreading blessing and peace throughout the earth. God promised Abraham that he would do this through Abraham's descendants, a people that would demonstrate to the world what true partnership and friendship with God really looked like. And the only problem was that Abraham and his wife were old, and they had no children. But not a problem, said God. I will give you a son. For reasons unknown to us, this son does not come right away. Abraham and Sarah got really anxious, maybe wondering, had they heard God right? Were they supposed to do something? And unfortunately, they decided they were supposed to do something. They took matters into their own hands. And unfortunately, in doing this, they abused a servant and muddied the waters with the birth of an illegitimate child. And nevertheless, God honored his promise, and in their very old age, they had a son of their own. Unfortunately, the consequences of their previous sin clouded this happy occasion, and right before this story that we've read today, we have this other very sad story featuring some very nasty behavior on Abraham and Sarah's part. So it was after all these things that God, looking at the world he loved, that was still spiraling back into chaos, had to test Abraham, his chosen instrument of peace. Let me say it again. Abraham showed great faith throughout these stories, but he also showed great sin, a great lack of faith. He was, in other words, a pretty ordinary guy, but he was tasked with perhaps the most important and extraordinary mission that anyone has ever been tasked with. God called out to Abraham, and Abraham, tuned to the voice of his divine friend, said, "Here I am." And God's test went like this: take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall tell you. It's true that Abraham lived in a different era of history than we do, and it's true that in that era, child sacrifice to the gods was fairly common practice. But even considering those circumstances, I don't think these are the words Abraham wanted to hear from God. These are words no one wants to hear, ever. I cannot imagine what was going through Abraham's head, and the Bible doesn't let us in on that. But I imagine, if I take a stab at imagining, I imagine it would be, he would be full of grief, fear, and darkness as he prepared and began that horrible trip. The other day, I heard the story of a woman named Jessica Kelly that I could not help but compare to Abraham's story. After a lifetime of longing to be a mother, Jessica and her husband found out that they were pregnant and gave birth to a healthy little boy that they named Henry. Their son grew into this happy and active little guy, but 4 years into his life, they found themselves in the midst of a really rough winter with Henry. He seemed to catch cold after cold and virus after virus, and despite bouts of antibiotics and many doctor's visits, they couldn't seem to keep Henry well. So when Henry began to tremble and eventually shake so bad that he couldn't walk, Jessica and her husband rushed him to the hospital. And it was there that they heard the words that no one ever wants to hear. "Your son has a rare and aggressive form of brain cancer, and there's nothing we can do." Over the next 8 weeks, the Kelly family turned their home into a hospice for Henry. And even though it was October, they decorated for Christmas, which was Henry's favorite time of year, and they prayed and they eased his pain as much as possible. And they waited. Jessica spoke of living in the tension of longing for and praying for a miracle, and at the same time preparing herself for the moment of Henry's death. And she remembers one terrible moment when Henry was in so much pain that she prayed that God would just take him right then and there, rather than allow him to continue suffering. And she says that's a pretty desperate place to be as a mom. People say a lot of dumb things when trying to bring comfort in the face of these unbelievably hard circumstances, when God isn't acting towards us in the way that we think he should. Things like, "God will never give you more than you can handle," and "everything happens for a reason." And these are things that many well-meaning Christians say out of, I think, good intentions, not because we're brilliant theologians who have solved the problem of pain and suffering, but because we are actually terrified of suffering, and because we haven't recognized that in order to walk closely with Jesus, every believer must be willing to walk through periods of very real pain, because Jesus walked through periods of very real pain. St. John of the Cross, a Spanish priest living 500 years ago, called these seasons in our lives where God seems completely absent or even against us the dark nights of the soul. And he taught his people not to fear them or try and run away from them, but actually to expect dark nights of the soul and to embrace them as part of every Christian's journey towards God. Peter Cesaro, who's the author of the book that we're using in our small groups, calls this the wall. And he says that every follower of Jesus must at some point in their lives, and probably at multiple points in their lives, confront and move through the wall. The hard reality is that all of us face the wall, and all of us face these dark nights of the soul, and usually more than one of them in our lives. It could be the loss of a job, a diagnosis, a mental health crisis, a betrayal by someone you trusted, a rebellious child, an injury, an inability to get pregnant, a deep desire to marry that remains unfulfilled, a loss of joy in our relationship with God, a divorce, the death of someone close. And for many of us, it throws our faith into disarray because it challenges the notion of a good and loving, ever-present God. And it challenges that secret pact we make deep in our hearts with God, that if we behave well and try our best to be good, he should come through for us and keep us from suffering. But this isn't the case. We find, though, that if we stay the course, and if we join Abraham in numbly moving through the journey that makes no sense, we will find that our ever-creative, ever-loving, ever-present God has somehow deepened the roots of our faith during the time that we actually thought we were losing it. So, if you're still mad about God asking Abraham to sacrifice his only child, so am I, but stick with me here. That's the whole point of the dark night of the soul, is actually that we don't understand what God's doing. We don't get it, but we keep moving as honestly and faithfully as possible. The second section details Abraham's journey. Abraham kept moving. He got up early, he chopped wood for the sacrifice, and found the flint for making the fire. He saddled his donkey and summoned a couple servants and his son Isaac, and then he set off on what was probably a 3-day journey. And even when he saw the place where he was supposed to make the sacrifice, he didn't freeze. He didn't say, wait, this is too much. I gotta turn around. He kept moving. The actions in this story flow swiftly one after the other without stopping until we get to this middle section where the flow of movement is interrupted by aged Isaac's heartbreaking question. In verse 7, he says, "My father," and everything stops. And Abraham responds like he did to God, "Here I am, my son." And Isaac continues, "Look, we have the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham in verse 8 says, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." And so they both went on together, and the action and the movement continues. Abraham's movement through this crisis and his response to Isaac's question reveal a number of things that can help us move through these dark nights of the soul, or to use Cesaro's term, the wall. So let's look at them. First, Abraham kept moving. Even when every part of us wants to quit, we are called to keep moving through these dark nights of the soul. My dark night of the soul came in my second year of seminary. Still processing much of the suffering I witnessed and experienced while working in Uganda, I ended up living with a friend who had also worked in development in that country. And over the course of the year, she began experiencing nightmares and severe anxiety and really scary periods of blackout. And she was soon diagnosed with severe PTSD. Following events of abuse in Uganda that her mind had actually blacked out in order for her to cope. And walking with this friend, I witnessed the leaders of her church reject her story and actually make her into the guilty party. I also witnessed things get a heck of a lot worse before they began to get better. And in the midst of this journey with my friend, my own faith was undergoing severe testing as my studies forced me to ask really hard questions and face the fact that I actually didn't have answers or good answers for a lot of things. In fact, for most things, if I'm honest, I began to wonder if I really could hear God's voice or if I had ever heard God's voice. And God himself began to feel like a stranger to me. And I wondered why I was sacrificing my future to work in the church that seemed to be rejecting my friend, that was rejecting my friend. And the worst part was that when I prayed, it felt like my words were just falling to the floor. I didn't sense God's presence. I didn't see evidence of his power or his healing. I was exhausted and sad and disillusioned. And in that year, the voice that I fought was the voice that said, just quit. Just cut your losses and go home. Pursue another master's degree. Take back your life. Maybe don't pray for a while. And also maybe take a break from church, because church was becoming a really painful experience. It was hard not to sit and feel really judgmental in church. Just give your poor heart and eyes a rest. But looking back, I'm so thankful that I didn't, that I kept moving. It was costly for me, even in terms of my own mental health. But on the other side, I see that it was one of the most maturing seasons for my faith. Ultimately, it isn't us that keeps moving through the wall or through these horrible seasons in our lives. It's God that moves us through the wall. God that is going deep and healing and transforming in us when we are feeling exactly the opposite. In fact, often it's when we feel like we're losing our faith that God is actually rooting it deeper. And our job in that place is not necessarily to figure it out or to feel it, but to obey, to go through the motions, to keep moving, not to avoid it or escape it or try and bounce off it, but to honestly move through the horror and pain of it, trusting that God is taking us to the other side where we will emerge with deeper healing and faith. And often these seasons last for a while. They're not just a weekend thing. They can be a year. They can be years. The second thing that we learn from Abraham is that it helps to have a good framework ahead of time. Now, this isn't always possible, but for many of us who are not currently in a dark night of the soul, this is very possible. You see, Abraham had already been through the grueling but ultimately profound experience of waiting for Isaac and messing it up really badly, and yet still seeing God come through faithfully in the most unexpected way. And this formed Abraham's framework going into this test. God is faithful. God works things out in miraculous ways that I don't understand, even when it feels like it's impossible. So listen to Abraham's pivotal words in verse 8. God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. God will provide. That was Abraham's framework for who God was going in. God had always provided, usually in unbelievable ways, and he would do it again. The mom I was speaking about earlier, Jessica Kelly, speaks of her framework that formed shortly before the news of her son's cancer. So as a nursing mom up late at night, she began listening to podcasts and sermons as a way of engaging her faith and having almost adult conversation, as she describes it. And some of these podcasts began to challenge her framework for God and his work in the world. Before she had subscribed to what she calls the blueprint worldview. And this is the idea that God is up in heaven and he has this sort of blueprint from the beginning of time to the end of time. And he's mapped everything out, all the courses of everyone's lives and all of the events. And we simply live and move and work within that thing that God has already knows, the beginning and the end of. But this idea began, she began to think through this. And it was challenged by the idea of a warfare worldview, which is the idea that God works within the limits of the world he created in order that we will freely choose love. So God limits himself in order that we can freely choose to love him and love others. But this limiting of himself allows evil and human sin to work, sometimes against, often against his will. Thus, everywhere we see life to the full and flourishing, we see God's will at work because he is a loving, faithful creator. But where we see death, suffering, and evil, we see his will being thwarted by these other wills, human or evil. So a couple years later, when the crisis with her son Henry hit, Jessica now believed that God was fighting for her son's life alongside her. He hadn't orchestrated his suffering, and they were just living it out in hopes that maybe God was going to change his mind. But they were fighting together. And when Henry eventually died, 8 weeks after his diagnosis, Jessica didn't see it as God's fault. Together, she saw her and God as warring against darkness and sin that took her son's life. And together, they were going to still fight for the fullness of life to emerge even from the ashes and from his death. Kelly has since written a book describing her story and how she held on to her faith in the midst of her 4-year-old's death. And it's really powerful stuff. Most of us don't love in our spare time to think through the problem of evil or even other theological conundrums. There are a weird handful of us that do like to do that, but most of us don't. Yet, as people of faith who are expecting to face and walk through dark nights of the soul, not only ourselves, but with others, we need to be those who think well and hard about our faith. One of my jobs as a pastor is to help equip you to do that. And it was really cool because even this past week, two of you emailed me with big theological questions, one about science and faith and one about homosexuality in the church, and asked for resources. And that is part of what Paul and I can help help equip you to do. I can promise you, I can guarantee you that we do not have answers to all of these theological conundrums, but we can help you build a framework, a stronger framework to think through some of these things. And you know what? Even after all of that, even after that hard work of thinking in the lighter seasons of life, sometimes our frameworks still don't hold up in crisis. And that feels terribly scary. That's part of what I was experiencing in my second year of seminary. But it's not a bad thing. It's good. If our framework didn't hold up, it's because it needed to be made stronger. And it's painful, but it's ultimately good when it breaks. When Isaac looked up at his father and said, "My father, what in the world is happening?" I seriously wonder whether or not Abraham's framework for God's faithfulness held firm. I think mine would have wavered. But in his words, Abraham puts the onus on God, not himself, to solve the ethical and theological dilemma at hand. He said, "God will provide. God is going to figure out a way out of this mess." And that was the right thing to do. Because the truth is, God really is beyond our understanding. He really is bigger than us, and his ways are beyond our ways. And the deeper we go into our faith, the more we know this, and the more comfortable I think we become with this truth, the more comfortable we become with the mystery of God and how he acts. Now, again, I'm not saying this is an excuse for lazy thinking. Sometimes we just say, "Oh, God's ways are beyond our ways," as an excuse to actually not think through something, or as a way of trying to avoid pain. And I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that when we're in the middle of crisis, when we're in the middle of a dark night of the soul, it's generally not the time to pick up our theology books and try and work on our framework. It's the time to get honest before God and put the onus on him to solve the problem. It's time for honest lament, for saying along with the psalmist, "I don't know why you're doing this, God. How long is this going to take?" It's a time for humility And it's a time when we need space to mourn and give ourselves the grace to be angry and to be in pain. And it's also the time to surround ourselves with a community of faith that can pray when we can't, when we don't have the words, and that can worship when we can't even bring ourselves to stand, let alone raise our hands. Isn't it a relief to know that it's okay to be in this place? It's okay to be in a dark night of the soul. And in fact, in a church this size, there's probably a few of us in that place at any given point. So let's be sensitive to that. Let's allow space for that. Let's not be too quick to judge or force a joyful testimony or a pat set of answers. Instead, let's learn to mourn with one another. And if you are in a place where you can pray with faith, then to pray with that faith for those who don't have the words. The final section in this story is marked by one more call to Abraham, and it's the most desperate call. And this time, just as he's lifting up the knife to kill his son Isaac, an angel of the Lord calls out, "Abraham, Abraham!" And Abraham responds as he has all along, "Here I am." And God, through this angel, says, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And looking up, Abraham sees a ram in the bushes and he sacrifices the ram instead. And God responds by affirming his blessing and promise on Abraham's life. Look, I'm not going to pretend that this story doesn't still trouble me at some level, or that I fully figured it out, but here is what I've come to. I'm convinced that if there were any other way for God to test Abraham other than offering up Isaac on the altar, God would have chosen that way. But I think this was truly the only way. And I'm not 100% sure why. I have some guesses that involve God's very own beloved world being already kind of on the altar of human ego, and Isaac kind of standing in for that. And I also wonder if Isaac would have ended up on this altar anyways, and God simply brought him and Abraham to this point earlier in order to show who he was and teach Abraham something very important about his character, and not just Abraham, but the world, who he was. But I don't know for sure. What I do know is that God didn't want any harm to come to Isaac. And we hear that very clearly in his words. And that God must have suffered the deepest agony in that moment when Abraham raised the knife. I think deeper than Abraham, deeper than Isaac, who we can't forget is also in this story. Because this is never what he intended when he created the world. You can hear it in his voice, can't you? Had the world not been in such deep chaos and had the stakes not been so high, I don't think the three of them would have been there at that altar on that mountain. Believe it was human choice and great evil that brought them to that mountain and to that horrible scene. But it was also obedience. And human choice partnered with God's loving action and God's incredible grace that got them off that mountain. And what joy and relief must have filled God's voice as he said, Now I know that you fear me because you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me. I don't believe that God orchestrates dark nights of the soul in our lives in order to test us or make us stronger or better. But I believe that in his vast creativity and deep love, he is able to transform the inevitable suffering we face into opportunities for healing and deepening our faith. Ultimately, this leads to the blessing and flourishing of all creation, which is another wonderful tidbit of this story. This isn't just about Abraham and God and Abraham's own personal faith. It's actually about the whole world, the destiny of the world, and about blessing the rest of creation. Our dark nights of the soul and the way we move through them, the reason we move through them are not just about us. As we move through them, the incredible thing is that God will bless creation through that as well. It's our job to walk through the dark night when it comes, as honestly and faithfully as we can, even when we feel numb, even when we feel like we're going through the motions, and even when we feel like we're losing our faith. Because the chances are, as history tells us, as countless saints before us have told us, in that moment, God is actually rooting it deeper. He's increasing our faith and our trust, as hard to understand as that is. We're going to celebrate communion now together as a church. And as Christians reading this story in the Old Testament, it's hard not to read it and think about Jesus. Think about the fact that God walked through a very similar dark night of the soul. Jesus, in dying on the cross and in living as a human in our world, experienced the darkest night of the soul. We serve a God who has not only enables us to get through this, but actually has walked through our dark night of the soul with us. We don't go through it alone. And even if we cannot feel it, it is Christ's hands that help us to keep moving. And it is Christ that helps us to build better frameworks as we think through God's work in the world. And it is Christ that emerged victorious on the other side and ensures that we will too. And Jesus took the bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise, he took the cup after they had eaten, saying, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood."